week in the studio, we've arrived at the point of no return years after Kansas released their most popular album ever.
We had a goal we were going to achieve or die trying. We did it, and nobody can ever take that away. I mean, it's something we have a shared experience that, no matter whatever happens, there's no way to remove that from you. It's a part of us. We're part of each other.
Dust in the wind.
Everything is dust in the wind.
Everything is dust in the wind. Turning like wildfire, falling like rain. Don't even promise, they only betray.
Hi, I'm Robbie Steinhardt of Kansas.
Hi, this is Steve Walsh of the band Kansas.
And this is Richard Williams, and we're in the studio.
Hi, this is Kerry Livgren.
I'm Phil Ehart of Kansas, in the studio for Point of No Return.
For years, the band called Kansas had struggled in small-town bars and dance halls, trying to get a break, trying to find a place for themselves and their music. There are 1,000 bands out there right now going through the same struggle, barely making enough money to pay the rent, spending endless nights in cheap motels. But they endure it in the hope that someday, somehow, they'll get their shot. And for the members of the band Kansas, six friends from Topeka, the dream came true. In 1976, Kansas had a triple platinum hit, an album called Left Overture. It was their fourth try. From then on, everything would be easy, or so they thought. But it wasn't. Success never is. What happened to the band Kansas is something that happens far too often. Instead of joy, the success brought pressure. The pressure created tension inside the band, and eventually, the friends from Topeka broke apart. Their dreams and their achievements lost in a swirl of lawsuits and angry words. It had begun even as they were making the follow-up to Left Overture, the album that was called, ironically enough, Point of No Return. It would be Kansas' most successful album. It would also mark the beginning of the end of the original band. Here's Kansas co-founder, Kerry Livgren.
You know, success is harder to live with than the road getting to it, I thought. I mean, we lived in some amazing poverty, and we had a really rough road, and people thought we were making all this money, and we were getting this little salary, like $7,500 a week. And all of a sudden, that changed rather abruptly and dramatically. You know, all of a sudden we had everything we ever wanted just tossed in your lap. You know, you've had this pie in the sky dream for like 10 years, and all of a sudden here you are. You got it. You know, what do you do next? Now, that's a hard thing to deal with in your life. It really is, because when you've got a direction, that's great. But when you get to the destination, you no longer have a direction. You're there. And that's real tough.
Show the way and leave today. Was it you that said, I love?
title song of their fifth album, Point of No Return, would go to top 30 on the singles chart. Even at their peak, Kansas was a band with no instantly recognizable stars. Steve Walsh sang most of the songs, and Kerry Livgren was the chief songwriter and lead guitarist. But on stage, violinist Robbie Steinhardt was often the one who interacted most with the audience, while bass player Dave Hope, drummer Phil Ehart, and guitarist Rich Williams stayed in the background. Here's Kerry Livgren.
In the band, everybody had their role. Everybody knew what everybody else's role was. We considered, it was never a spoken rule, but we considered ego to be the enemy. Dave's function, interestingly enough, I've never been in another band that had a guy like this. He felt like his calling was to put everybody in their place. If he saw somebody getting out of hand, boy, he had a way of just bringing you right down to earth. You know, he'd make some comment or something that would just chop you right down. In a good way, a constructive way. Phil was the organizational leader. He was the guy who made a lot of the real pragmatic decisions about the band. I kind of surfaced as the musical leader. I sort of was the rudder that steered us in whatever direction we went. Steve was the singer and an additional writer who had a lot to contribute. Robbie had a totally unique function as a violinist and second vocalist and MC in a live situation. Robbie was the link between the band on stage and the audience. Everybody had their roles.
It was their preceding album, their fourth, 1976's Left Overture, containing the hit Carry On Wayward Son, that had changed everything for Kansas, according to lead singer, keyboard player Steve Walsh.
I can still remember the people that handled all the accounting and everything. I called them because at the time, I think we were, you know, right before Wayward Son hit, we were all on, I don't know, some kind of salary from the band. And we all got like $75 or $100 a week. And then I started to hear Wayward Son on the radio and understand that we were a bit more successful. I had no idea how well it was doing. And I remember calling them one day and saying, is there any way that we can get maybe $150 a week, you know, instead of $100 or $125? Mm. And they said, well, you know, you can have a lot more than that if you want. And I said, what? You know, this was so, oh, boy, I mean, it was a wonderful feeling. I'll never forget that as long as I live. It was a great phone call.
Kansas had been together for 6 years and recorded three albums by the time Left Overture became a hit in 1976. With all the attention that suddenly came their way, writing songs for a follow-up album wasn't easy. Phil Ehart, co-founder of Kansas, remembers.
We came home. At this time, most of the guys, I mean, even though a lot of money had come in, a lot of guys were still kind of living in apartments and stuff. You know, there was money put away, but it was kind of like we just did a triple platinum album. And now we've got to top that. And it was like, okay, well, let's just see what happens. But it really didn't click till all six of us walked in the room. All of a sudden, here's this entity somehow that worked. When you factioned it, it didn't work. But when the six of us were in the rehearsal hall, all of a sudden, Dust in the Wind pops up. Steve walks in with Point of No Return. He walks in with Closet Chronicles. All of a sudden, these songs that made the album what it was just boom. You know, because the six of us were there, we were running through things, we were practicing things, we were all coming up with ideas, names for album titles, you know, all kinds of things that were used and that each guy spurred on the other guy.
Once carried through the current and being swept away, the king is in the closet, he's hiding from today, and though he owns all of fortune, this room is where he'll world is filled with darkness, turning gray. Gazing out the window of the 42nd floor, he is separate from all others. No one knocks upon his door, and it might as well be raining, 'cause the sunlight
enjoy it, where innocence plays with all the laughing children, the kind who are crying right now. A taste of freedom from the pain of everything here I see. Life is sweet, but I took it all for granted, and now I don't know if I can ever tell you just what we permit we allow. Allow me to forget the life I've made my own.
Closet Chronicles was written by Steve Walsh and Kerry Libgren, like most of the songs on Point of No Return. When we come back, we'll find out who the song Portrait is really about. Follow In the Studio on Facebook and check out more at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, and you're in the studio for the Kansas Point of No Return.
Welcome back to In the Studio for Kansas Point of No Return.
I'm Phil Ehart of Kansas.
I'm Kerry Livgren.
And I'm Redbeard.
Perhaps the person who felt the most pressure after the success of the Kansas album Left Overture was vocalist Steve Walsh. Normally a fine songwriter, during Left Overture, Walsh had hit a writer's block during the recording of the album. He was determined not to have that happen again with Point of No Return. The pressure on Steve Walsh was so great that at one point during the recording, he quit the band. Phil Ehart remembers the times.
Steve was the more rock side of Kansas and the songs that he wrote and how he wanted the band to be. And we were getting anything but rockier. Maybe Lightning's Hand or Sparks of the Tempest or maybe just a couple songs on this album were really rock-oriented. And I think Steve always wanted to rock more. And it was a compromise for him. He wanted to rock harder, but okay, we could rock hard for a while, but then we had to turn around and do Dust in the Wind or something else like that. And I know that bugged him, and he and Carrie were going at it pretty heavy, but that's the way anything great comes out, is through conflict. I mean, it's just, you got to fight and scratch, and usually the great stuff survives, and that's what happened. You know, this Point of No Return turned out to be our largest selling album ever.
Voice of a dreamer scream, calls us upon.
Livgren wrote or co-wrote 8 of the 10 songs of Point of No Return, including Lightning's Hand. With a title like that, it was begging for special effects in concert.
When we were touring for the Point of No Return tour, we thought, we've got to have something in our show, in our live show, that nobody's ever had. We want to do something really different. You know, we don't want to use smoke bombs, and we don't want to use all the usual stuff. So we kind of put the word out. We wanted something different. Well, these people contacted us, and they said, look, you guys, we think we've got exactly what you need. You got this song, Lightning's Hand. We've invented a lightning machine that will make bolts of lightning in the concert hall. We thought, hey, man, this sounds really cool. So we rented this huge warehouse down by the Atlanta airport. We said, okay, you bring the machine up there. We'll set up the panel, and let's try this thing out. So these guys brought this ominous-looking big machine in there. It had big electrodes on it. It looked like something out of a Frankenstein movie. You know, these things are... And we were standing there just transfixed at this thing, and the guy came up to Robbie, who sang that song, Lightning's Hand. He said, okay, what you do is you hold this sword in your hand, and there's a cord that runs out of the sword down to your foot to ground you. And he says, when you get to that line in the song where you say, I command the lightning's hand, you hold out the sword, we'll flip the switch, and the bolt of lightning will jump across the stage and hit your sword and go right out through the cord, and you won't feel anything. Well, Robbie looked quiet as a ghost. Well, first of all, he gets out there, and we're thinking, oh, man, this is going to be great. All of a sudden, the guy turns on the machine, and Robbie's mountain of hair starts sticking straight up and moving all over the place, and he looked really bizarre. And he got to that line in the song, and the bolt of lightning jumped out and bit him right on the neck, knocked him down on the ground. He's like writhing around on the ground. This thing's going bzz, bzz, bzz. Shut it off, shut it off. It scared the devil out of me. We tried it at one concert, the first concert on that tour, on the Point of No Return tour. We were in Miami. We turned on the lightning machine, and it jumped out and blew about half the speakers in the PA, so we thought, this ain't going to work.
Good call. Among Kerry Livgren's 8 contributions to Point of No Return was the song Portrait, which intrigued fans like me for years as to its source of inspiration.
I've always been a very avid reader, read a lot of science fiction, read a lot of philosophy, a lot of religious books, a lot of science, and I was always fascinated by Albert Einstein and the fact that he went so far with mathematics and physics that he actually crossed the line into metaphysics and philosophy. And he was actually getting at the very fabric of the universe. And I thought, what an amazing man. And I was so fascinated with the guy, one day I wrote a song about him. The interesting thing about Portrait is that nobody seemed to catch on who it was about. I mean, the list of people who they thought that was about was incredibly long, and people would come up with all these reasons why this is who they thought it was about. And they would always corner me and say, hey, who's that about? When I would say Albert Einstein, they'd give me this blank look like, wow, I never thought of that, you know, so... Whenever you can stimulate people to think and to speculate and stuff, I consider it a success. You know, that was one of my personal goals in songwriting was to make people use their brain cells.
song Portrait goes from a shuffle to a gallop on Point of No Return, written by Carrie Livgren, whose conversion to Christianity soon after was one of the factors that led to him eventually leaving the band Kansas. In 1988, Livgren rewrote the lyrics to Portrait so that they would be about Jesus Christ. Up next, Kansas guitarist Richard Williams joins former violinist and singer Robbie Steinhardt, current drummer Phil Ehart, former singer and keyboard player Steve Walsh, and guitarist keyboard player Carrie Livgren in the studio for the Point of No Return.
Welcome back to In the Studio for Kansas Point of No Return.
I'm Phil Ehart of Kansas.
I'm Carrie Livgren.
And I'm Redbeard. Point of No Return by Kansas. It's a 6 million seller and hit number 4 on the album chart. Kansas had developed a reputation by this time for making serious progressive rock. But boys will be boys, according to original member Carrie Livgren.
Another time, you know, on the Point of No Return tour, we had a plexiglass stage, and the lighting was down underneath us. It was really nice. But I was out there playing Dust in the Wind one night, and I looked down, and directly underneath me was a stark naked girl lying on her back looking up at me, who someone had talked into going under there. And it was a little difficult to concentrate on, you know, on this philosophical, spiritual song with a naked girl parading around underneath you, you know. I mean, there was always stuff going on that the audience either sometimes was unaware of, other times they did see it, you know, dropping plastic chickens from down from the lights. I mean, there's just all kinds of crazy stuff that went on.
Thank you.
The paradox of this, their biggest selling album, is that the song which drove the album sales to quadruple platinum, Dust in the Wind, wasn't intended for this or any other Kansas album. Matter of fact, according to band co-founder and former member Kerry Livgren, it wasn't even a song, really.
The way the song came about, I've always been as a lead guitar player of the band, I've been a rock and roll electric guitar player, and I've never really been an acoustic guitar player. So I was kind of trying to expand my musical horizons, and I had this acoustic guitar, and I was trying to learn to finger pick. So I made up this finger exercise to teach myself to finger pick, and I was sitting in my music room playing this thing, and my wife walked by, and she stood there and listened for a second. She goes, "Boy, that's really pretty. You should make words to that." I said, "No, honey, I'm just trying to learn how to do this." She goes, no, that's really nice. You know, don't forget that now." And she kept bugging me about this pretty thing. You know, she really seemed to latch onto it. So I made it into a song. And once again, we were almost done with rehearsal for Point of No Return. Pretty well learned all the songs. And we kind of got to the end of things. And they said, "Have you got any more songs?" And I said, "Well, I've got this one, but you guys wouldn't like it. I mean, this is not Kansas. You know, this, I'm really hesitant to even play it." "Nah, come on, play the song." So I played the song on acoustic guitar, and everybody kind of stood there and said, "We need to be doing this song." And I was amazed. In fact, I rejected the whole idea. I actually fought with the band over, you know, the fact that we shouldn't do this song. I thought, this is not us. Well, it shows you what I know about, you know, the value of a song, because it turned out to be our biggest hit ever. More people seemed to identify with what I said in that song, and that really surprised me, because in a way, that's kind of a dismal song, you know. I was reading a book of American Indian poetry one day, and I came across that line. This American Indian said, "For all we are is dust in the wind." And I thought, well, you know, that's really true. Here I've got all this success. I've got all this material possessions. I've got a goal in my life that has been accomplished at that point. But I'm going back into the ground, and what does this really mean in light of that? And that's really kind of the message of that song. But the amazing thing was that so many people identified with it, and that song ended up on the country charts, on the middle of the road chart, easy listening. I mean, it crossed all kinds of boundaries.
I close my eyes only for a moment, and the moment's gone. All my dreams pass before my eyes, a curiosity. Dust in the wind, all they are is dust in the wind. Same old song, just a drop of water in an endless sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. Dust in the wind, all we are is dust in the wind. Oh.
song has taken on a life of its own, according to Kansas guitarist Richard Williams, followed by drummer Phil Ehart and violinist Robbie Steinhardt.
Because what the crowd gives back, I mean, Dust the Wind is just a finger exercise to me, but when we play it live, the first note, people come out of their chairs, and it really does kind of breathe all by itself. That's pretty incredible.
When did you first start to respect that instead of almost fear it?
That's a good question.
I think there's a couple times with Dust in the Wind, since I don't play on it, I kind of get a different, you know, I can kind of get a different perspective because I'm standing off to the side of the stage watching what's going on. There's a couple times, first time in Germany, when we had about 40 to 50,000 Germans singing in unison. I mean, it was, like Rich said, it's almost the kind of thing you can almost stop because they're going to sing the song and they're going to know. Also, when we played West Point, it would be the Army Academy, you know, West Point Academy, where all the cadets stood in unison and sang in full dress in their, you know, in their full dress uniforms that they wore to the concert. They all sang, you know, it was like, you know, 900, 1,000 men standing there singing "Dust in the Wind." That was more the serious one. In the last couple of years, we've referred to different crowds as a "Dust and Bolt" crowd. And what that means exactly is in the middle of the show, we had Dust in the Wind, and as soon as we played Dust,
they'd bolt.
So there would be times when we knew that, oh, we got a Dust and Bolt crowd tonight. Obviously, this crowd is here to hear Dust in the Wind, and they don't care about anything else we're going to play. And when they hear Dust, they buy a T-shirt and haul butt. So that's, you know, that's it.
You're right about that, though. They won't let us sing the song. I mean, it is their song now. Yeah. I'm just overwhelmed by this. They didn't do this when I left the band.
That's right.
I mean, it's just so awesome. When was it we found out from Kerry? Was it last year that the song's been played over 2 million times?
Oh, my God.
So it's bona fide.
Steve Walsh compares those times and now with Richard Williams.
I've always said that my best memories are of this band is while we were trying to make it, not as the famous band that we were for a brief period of time, because that was an excessive period where you walked around with your head in a cloud and you didn't relate to anything or anybody because you didn't have to, or at least I didn't have to.
You were always the underdog. And you were always told that you couldn't play this kind of music being from Topeka, that guys from Topeka couldn't play that kind of music and couldn't play it that well. And I still think you've got basically a chip on your shoulder, and I think that's why you've sustained. I think if you hadn't been from Topeka and that if it had come any easier than it came, I think you would have probably quit about 15 years ago. That's my theory.
That's probably not too far off the mark, you know. But, you know, for whatever reason, we're still standing.
And while he's not an actual member of Kansas today, Kerry Livgren's memories certainly are fond ones.
If anything destroyed that early version of Kansas or caused it to cease to be, I think it was success. Success eventually, I don't care who you are, will get to you. And we began to quibble with one another and fight over the direction of the band, and it eventually caused us to fragment. We beat the odds. I mean, we came out of a place where the odds were so stacked against us, not only in what we had access to as far as trying to get a record deal and all that. We have such an incredible path. I mean, we hung together when the times were harder than most people ever imagined we went through. I mean, I tell people about 1970, the year that in the entire year, I made $5. I mean, that's below any known poverty level. I know. I mean, we ate rice. We went through an experience. We all made a pact. We had a goal we were going to achieve or die trying. We did it, and nobody can ever take that away. I mean, it's something we have a shared experience that you know, no matter whatever happens, there's no way to remove that from you. It's a part of us. We're part of each other.
Thank you.
nothing lives within. I look around and I find no trace to tell me what has been. So far I've come to find there's no one here, no life I fear. I came for nothing, they have gone, and nobody's home. Carved in stone in memory of the dead. For those who made this place do not remain, they feel no pain. A stranger fate was never known.
So full of so many great songs that it's easy to overlook Nobody's Home from Point of No Return by Kansas. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking my guests in Kansas, past and present. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2017, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net.